Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Good evening. We begin tonight with breaking news. Two major developments from the House January 6th Select Committee, both suggesting it's now aiming higher and closer to the former president than ever before. First, subpoenas for three of the attorneys in his bid to overturn the election, Rudy Giuliani, Jenna Ellis, and Sidney Powell, as well as campaign advisor Boris Epstein, who was working with Giuliani at what's been called the Willard Hotel's command center. Then there's this, and it marks a serious escalation for the committee. Exclusive CNN reporting on subpoenas naming a Trump child and a possible future in-law that has already gotten results. CNN special correspondent Jimmy Gangale broke the news tonight, joins us now. So who in the former president's family does the subpoena involve?
So, Anderson, according to multiple sources, the January 6th committee has subpoenaed and obtained phone records from two people very close to former President Trump, his son, Eric Trump, as well as Kimberly Guilfoyle, who is engaged to his other son, Donald Trump Jr. And as you pointed out, this appears to be the first time the committee has issued a subpoena targeting one of the Trump children. It really underscores just how aggressive the committee is willing to be in its investigation. We reached out. Eric Trump declined to comment on the subpoena of his call records. But a source familiar with his thinking tells me, quote, he's not losing sleep over it. We also reached out to an attorney for Kimberly Guilfoyle, who told us the subpoena is, quote, of no consequence to her because she has absolutely nothing to hide or to be concerned about. For the record, Anderson, the committee declined to comment on the subpoenas.
So in your reporting, do you know why the committee is interested in Kimberly Guilfoyle and Eric Trump's phone records?
So we don't know yet, but it's my understanding the committee has made it a practice when it comes to issuing subpoenas, it's for a very specific reason. These are not just blanket requests for records. So as an example, there's no evidence that the committee reached out for call records for Trump's other children, Don Jr., Ivanka, or his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. And just for context, I want to explain a call detail record. We reported on this in the fall, or a CDR. This gives the committee a phone log of the date, time, and length of incoming and outgoing calls. It's also a phone log of text messages, but it is not the substance or content of the calls or messages. It is, however, a critical investigative tool as the committee pieces together really a roadmap of who is communicating with whom before, during, and after January 6th.
And as you mentioned, four of the former president's one-time lawyers and advisors have also been subpoenaed. What's the committee hoping to learn from them, and any sense whether they'll comply?
I think the chances are slim to none of any of these four complying, maybe none to none. But the committee is making a record. They're saying these are critical witnesses. And when you look at these four names, they're all involved in perpetuating the big lie. And at least two of them, Giuliani and Boris Epstein, were at the Willard Hotel on January 5th, the night before, in that war room. We understand communicating with then-President Trump. So I think this is critical. These are four critical people that the committee wants to say, we're going after you whether or not you comply. Mm.
Jimmy Gangale, appreciate it.
Sure.
Let's drill down more on this. We're joined by CNN Chief Legal Analyst Jeffrey Toobin, CNN Senior Law Enforcement Analyst and former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, also CNN Senior Political Correspondent Abby Phillip, host of Inside Politics Sunday. So, Andrew, how significant could these call logs or phone records be to the investigation?
So, Anderson, the records are exactly as Jamie described them. They give you the incoming and outgoing numbers that were called from that person's account and the time the calls went through and their duration. they are crucial in setting up a timeline of that person's contacts and communications. They don't tell you what they said, but they tell you exactly when they talked to specific other people. It is usually a record that you want to see very closely before you call that person in for an interview, because you want to be able to ask very specific questions about, did you speak to this person? And when you spoke to them, what did they say? What did you discuss? Those sorts of things. So I would look at these subpoenas as possibly a signal that subpoenas for testimony from these two people would probably be forthcoming.
Jeff, I mean, to be clear, would Eric Trump and Kimberly Guilfoyle have been aware that their phone records were being subpoenaed? Would they have had means to try to stall it? Or did they have to agree to it?
The answer is they are probably told by the phone company that the records have been subpoenaed. That's the custom. But they had no they have no legal right to stop it. This is a subpoena to the phone company. Their participation is not invited or allowed. So the great advantage of this kind of evidence gathering by the committee is that the subjects really have no ability to delay, which, of course, is such a big problem in this investigation.
Abby, just in terms of the politics, the political impact, what could the fallout be to this, the fact that the committee has seized records pertaining to one of the president's sons?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think these individuals are among the closest to former President Trump. And so it just highlights that the investigation is everyone around him, including members of his own family. I was also struck because I think this is a basic practice for in Trump world. A lot of the things that President Trump does not go through official channels. It goes through people who are on the outside. In fact, the first time President Trump was impeached, it was because he was using outside channels to allegedly conduct his effort to dig up dirt on Joe Biden. And so it would not surprise me that these subpoenas that seem to be inching closer and closer to the president don't involve people with White House titles. They involve people on the outside who are in close communication with him. And I think that that actually highlights even more how serious they are and what information they could potentially have about the president's involvement or lack of involvement in the riots and the January 6th rally.
And Andrew, in a case like this, do they have to have specific information in order to get this information from phone companies? I mean, why not, if they haven't gone after Donald Trump Jr.'s phone records, does that mean they have some specific thing they're interested in Guilfoyle and Eric Trump about?
You know, the standard for a subpoena of this sort is a simple relevance standard, that those phone records might contain information that's relevant to the investigation. Well, that's pretty broad. But I think what Jamie said is accurate. It seems from the subpoenas that we've seen come out of the committee so far, they are actually going after specific people, specific times, and likely specific conversations. Hmm. So I would expect that there was a fairly specific motivation behind these. But in truth, on the legal level, you don't need that sort of specificity.
And Jeff, now that you've got these new subpoenas for, Giuliani, Sidney Powell, Jenna Ellis, kind of the whole rogues gallery of attorneys, I just want to remind people of the caliber of arguments they were making in the early days of the big lie. Let's watch.
So we have mathematical evidence in a number of states of massive quantities of Trump votes being trashed, just simply put in the trash like you would on your computer with any file, and Biden votes being injected.
So that didn't happen. What do you make it? I mean, even if they didn't cooperate, what's the point of doing this?
Well, because you have to say at the end of your investigation, we sought the testimony of these relevant figures, especially if in your final report, you're going to say they engaged in improper behavior. But let's remember, Rudy Giuliani is under very serious criminal investigation in the Southern District of New York. There has already been a search warrant for his electronic devices. His lawyer can talk all he wants about executive privilege, about attorney-client privilege. The reason Rudy Giuliani is not going to testify is he is going to take the Fifth, because any intelligent lawyer would tell his client to take the Fifth under those circumstances. Very similar with Sidney Powell, who is also under a different kind of criminal investigation. So the chances of them testifying are non-existent. But I think the committee is doing its due diligence in saying, hey, we want to hear from you if you want to talk.
And Andrew, I mean, again, going after attorneys for the former president, how problematic is that?
I mean, it's incredibly problematic, right? Under the best circumstances, there are all sorts of attorney-client privilege and executive privileges that could apply. Those are all, you know, formidable grounds for opposing the subpoenas. And let's face it, in this crowd, we know they like to litigate, they like to obstruct, they like to delay. So you can pretty much guarantee that that's going to happen.
I mean, this is the kind of thing, you know, Abby, that they, I mean, I don't know how Sidney Powell makes a living, but if she does fundraising or sells T-shirts or whatever, this is something she, you know, that a person of that caliber would like to use, the fact that they've been asked and are, you know, fighting back.
Oh, 100%. I mean, both Giuliani and Sidney Powell are two individuals who use these types of investigations as fodder to gin up support among the president's base. And, you know, whether or not they use that to help, you know, raise money or do whatever they do, it's part of how, you know, the president's supporters build sort of a wall of support among people who believe these lies that they've been spewing, and they use it actually to bolster their position. I mean, just a couple of days ago, President Trump was at a rally, basically calling all of this a political prosecution, the prosecution of January 6th rioters. I imagine he'll be saying much of the same thing about these individuals who were very close to him and who he relied on, frankly, as the source of all of this nonsense around the 2020 election.
Yeah, Abby, go ahead, Jeff.
Can I offer a bit of a dissent from that? You know, it's going to cost Giuliani, Powell, hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees. And Donald Trump never helps anybody but himself. They are going to be on the hook for all that money. I don't think this is good for them. I don't think they are going to make a lot of money off this. I think this is a bad deal for them. Mm.
Jeff Toobin, Andrew McCabe, Abby Phillip, appreciate it. Coming up next, breaking news about the state of Russian military deployments around Ukraine and the Biden administration preparing for an invasion that it says could come at any moment. Senator Chris Murphy, just back from Ukraine, joins us. Later, the Supreme Court justice, who wrote a book arguing for greater civility, yet stands alone and not wearing a mask around a colleague who's reportedly at high risk from COVID. It's hard to imagine that the world could be on the brink of a major land war in Europe, not to mention a return to the kind of climate of fear not seen since the Cold War. Yet that is where we are, with Russian forces now menacing Ukraine. According to the Ukrainian Defense Ministry's latest intelligence assessment, shared exclusively with CNN, Russia has now deployed more than 127,000 troops in the region. At the White House, Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters an attack could come, quote, at any point. And tonight, multiple sources tell CNN the Biden administration is weighing new options to either deter Russian President Vladimir Putin or raise the price he would pay for using those forces. CNN Chief National Security Correspondent Jim Sciutto joins us now with the latest. What are these new options being considered? Do we know?
Anderson, the idea here is to grow lethal military assistance to the Ukrainian military, both from the U.S. and its NATO allies, in a host of ways, to increase supplies of anti-tank, armor-piercing missiles known as javelins, to increase supplies of anti-aircraft, shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missile systems known as MANPADs. Those would come from NATO allies, mortars as well. You see some pictures there of those javelin missiles. But also, crucially, the possibility of increasing the presence of U.S. Special Operations Forces trainers for the Ukrainian military. They already regularly rotate in and out in Ukraine, but increasing that presence. And the goals here are, one, to increase the costs of a potential Russian invasion, frankly, in the simplest terms, to make it potentially bloodier for the Russian military, but also to, over time, prepare the Ukrainian military for sustained resistance to a Russian occupation. In other words, equipping them for the long haul here.
Are there signs that diplomacy has failed or is failing?
Not clear that it has failed yet, but they came out of a week of meetings in Europe last week with no signs of any breakthroughs or really any concrete progress. So increasing pessimism among administration officials I speak to, people in the Pentagon, that diplomacy is providing the outcome that the administration wants here. They're not closing those doors. An important conversation today between Antony Blinken and Sergey Lavrov. But the sad fact is that the diplomatic off-ramp that the U.S. has offered Russia, it hasn't taken. So they are making preparations for raising the costs for Russia if that's indeed where we end up. And Anderson, you know, I've been talking to folks for months about this situation, and it's clear that the pessimism is frankly increasing.
Jim Rusciuto, I appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah. Joining us right now is Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy, who's just back from Kiev, where he and a bipartisan congressional delegation met with Ukraine's president. Senator Murphy, appreciate you joining us. Do you think the U.S. should and will move to increase the lethality of weaponry to Ukraine?
Well, as you know, Anderson, the United States has been the most significant security partner with Ukraine since the initial Russian incursion into Ukrainian territory in 2014. We've provided lethal assistance, non-lethal assistance. We've had literally thousands of trainers inside Ukraine. And I expect that that security commitment will continue. In fact, it should grow. The United States Congress just a few weeks ago passed legislation increasing the authorization for direct military assistance to Ukraine. And I think it's incredibly important right now that we make Russia understand that, well, you know, there may not be U.S. brigades on the ground fighting Russian soldiers. There's going to be continued U.S. assistance, assistance to an army that's ready to fight and a population that is not just going to let Russia march into the center of Ukraine. Putin seems to be getting absolutely horrible advice. People telling him that he's going to be greeted as some kind of liberator in a country that has turned against Russia over the last 10 years and is going to fight for its survival. So I think Ukrainians can stand up for themselves, but I do agree this is a time for the United States to increase our security commitment. And that was the purpose of the trip, to have Republicans and Democrats there showing Ukraine, showing Russia, more importantly, that despite the sort of divisions you see in Washington between Republicans and Democrats on other issues, we're going to be together supporting more assistance to Ukraine.
So you actually think there would be bipartisan support in the United States and Congress for helping Ukraine?
I do. I mean, listen, there may be outliers on both parties that might oppose certain lethal assistance to Ukraine. But I think it's absolutely critical that we continue to be a security partner. Remember, we're just helping Ukraine so that they can decide for themselves their future. Russia is invading because they want to force Ukraine to orient to the east. The United States supports Ukraine's right to decide for themselves whether they want to have an alliance with NATO or EU or whether they want to have an alliance with Russia. We're supporting Ukraine's democratic future, whereas Russia is proposing an invasion or threatening invasion to force the Ukrainian people into an alliance with Russia that they don't want.
Do you have, I mean, having been there, do you have a sense of what a conflict would look like for Ukraine? I mean, obviously, Russia has massive military might, but it's not like annexing Crimea, where there's a large, you know, pro-Russian population. The rest of Ukraine is much different than that.
So back in 2012, before Russia invaded Ukraine's east, you know, there was probably 20-30% support in Ukraine for joining NATO. Today, that number is 60-70%. This is a country that has awakened since the initial Russian invasion and has become, you know, inherently anti-Russia. They want a future with the West. They are going to fight for their country. And so this, to me, would be the biggest mistake of Vladimir Putin's career. He will get bogged down inside Ukraine, just like his predecessors got bogged down in Afghanistan in 1980 and 1981. The Ukrainians are going to fight for their lives. There will be a long-term counterinsurgency. It will be bloody. It will be drawn out. And it will be a black mark on Russia that could end up leading to Russia's downfall, as the Afghanistan invasion arguably contributed to the Soviet Union's downfall. So this is a big decision moment for Putin. And well, I'm not sure that we're going to get some magical diplomatic agreement. We can certainly raise the costs to Putin and make clear to him that this is going to be long drawn out and very ugly, and that in the end he'll wish he never set foot any further inside Ukraine.
What is your sense of why Russia is doing this now? I mean, obviously, you know, their concerns about Ukraine joining NATO are well known. Why now?
Listen, I think that Putin sort of sees the end of his career coming. He has long believed that the breakup of the Soviet Union was the worst thing that ever happened to his nation. And he sees his legacy as attached to reconstructing some version of the old USSR. I think he also has been given very bad information. There are reports suggesting that he's been told that Ukraine is actually just waiting to be invited back into the Soviet Empire, and he'll be greeted as a liberator. So I think part of this stems from sort of his completion of a legacy project, but part of this is also due to his bad advice. The last piece of this is that he knows that the time is running out. Ukraine is getting more anti-Russian, more interested in joining the West every single day. There is not going to be an election which results in a Ukrainian leader ultimately deciding to do an alliance with Russia. The only way that he can force Ukraine back in his orbit is through his own use of force. So he's gotten to this point at which the only thing he can do is to propose and move forward with an invasion like this. We've just got to make sure that we raise the prospective costs.
You sit on the Committee of Foreign Relations, obviously. Do you feel as though the United States and European allies are on the same page when it comes to how to deal with the threat from Russia?
I think it's taken a little bit of time to convince our European allies of the seriousness of this threat. Remember, Russia had tens of thousands, close to 100,000, maybe a little bit more, troops on Ukraine's border in the spring conducting exercises. I think we've had to spend some time with our European allies to convince them that this is serious and that together our proposed sanctions that we make clear to Russia should they invade will be imposed could in fact be the necessary deterrent. So my sense is the British have been with us from the beginning and that other European allies are coming along to our view and are now finally willing to sort of put up a set of potential sanctions that may ultimately be dispositive in convincing Putin that it's just not worth it.
Yeah, well, let's hope that works. Senator Chris Murphy, appreciate it. Thank you. Virginia's new governor has rescinded mask mandates for schools, but some school districts are keeping it in place. Why and how parents are reacting next. A new COVID development tonight. The federal government's website to get free test kits is up and running. It's covidtests.gov. Also, word from the CDC that 3/4 of the U.S. population has gotten at least one vaccine dose. Progress, certainly, but still short of many other parts of the world. Meantime, New York State, where the latest surge hit early, is now showing signs of a steep decline in cases. Much the same across the Northeast. Not yet the case in much of the country, however. On the school front, there's some new data points. An overview of 36 studies in 11 countries published in JAMA Pediatrics finding consistent negative health effects of school closings on kids, which especially when it comes to kids' mental health. Also today, the American Academy of Pediatrics reporting new childhood cases rose 69% last week. Hospitalizations held steady. Now, with all that on the table, there's also the case of Virginia's new governor, Glenn Youngkin. On Saturday, his first day in office, he rescinded the Commonwealth's K-12 mask mandate. And in some schools, that's not been welcome. Gary Tuchman went to Virginia and filed this report.
10 minutes away from the Virginia State Capitol building, where new Governor Glenn Youngkin was inaugurated this past weekend, is Richmond's Westover Hills Elementary School, where an executive order he issued is getting panned.
We will be maintaining our mask mandate.
Jason Camras is the superintendent of Richmond's 55 public schools. Here in Richmond and a number of other school districts across the state, there's concern that without mask mandates, the spike in COVID cases will only get worse. Anna Mason is the mother of a second grade daughter at the Westover Hills School. She says despite her superintendent's stance, the governor's order, which takes effect next Monday, is very concerning.
I feel really disappointed.
Why? Yeah.
Because I'm scared. I'm scared for my kid. I'm scared for her classmates. Yeah, and I feel like this is, what other protection do we have?
Dion McCormick is the mother of a fourth grader.
Your school district says we're not listening to the governor.
Right.
We want our kids in our school to still wear their masks. How do you feel about that?
I feel like they're protecting us. They're protecting our kids. I love it.
Notably, one of the governor's children goes to a private out-of-state high school that does have a mask mandate. We wanted to ask the governor about that and about school districts in his state defying his order, but our request to speak with him was declined. However, his spokesperson did send us a statement saying, "The governor is allowing Virginians to opt out of the mask mandates so that parents can choose what's best for their children." Over the weekend, the governor did say on camera that school districts need to listen to parents.
"Because we will use every resource within the governor's authority to explore what we can do and will do in order to make sure that parents' rights are protected."
And he does indeed get some support from parents at the Richmond school.
"It still should be a choice. Nobody should be able to be forced to do anything."
"So you agree with the governor?"
"Yes."
Robin Sneed is the grandmother of a second grader.
"I know what it feels like for me to have a mask on, and it's hard for me to breathe. So I can only imagine how they feel, the children."
But at this school, a majority of parents we talk to feel differently.
"Governor says that should be up to the parent. It shouldn't be up to the schools. Parents should make the decisions for their own children." Your reaction?
"I don't know if I agree with that, because their decisions affect my child."
It's not clear what Governor Youngkin can do, wants to do, or will do when it comes to school districts that disobey his executive order. Either way, though, this district shows no signs of backing down.
Are you concerned your school district could be punished by the governor for not listening to what he's saying?
"I think we'll have to take it day by day. And of course, if there are any repercussions, we will do our very best to defend ourselves and to continue forward with what we believe is right."
This parent agrees with that plan of action.
"Because I think I care about everyone and we're responsible for everyone.
So everyone should be responsible for each other."
"Exactly, yeah. Boo."
Gary joins us now from Richmond. So you're outside a school board meeting. I take it they'll be discussing this issue?
They just discussed it, Anderson, and they passed a resolution endorsing the decision made by their superintendent. I can tell you there are a number of districts around the state that either say we're sticking with the mask mandate or still considering it. And private schools are part of this, too. The order affects private schools. I talked to a spokesperson for the diocese here. The diocese, the Catholic diocese, has about 30 schools. It's a very large diocese, Richmond. And they are maintaining the mask mandate right now. However, they say they will seek guidance from the Virginia Department of Health. They will review the governor's order and then announce if they're going to make any change before the deadline day when this all takes effect, this coming Monday.
Anderson. Gary, appreciate it. Thanks very much. Now to the Supreme Court, where Justice Sonia Sotomayor today, who has diabetes, a pre-existing condition, took part in oral arguments remotely. This while Justice Neil Gorsuch, again, was the only member to enter the courtroom without a mask. He's also the justice who recently wrote a book decrying the lack of civility in the country. More on this from CNN Supreme Court reporter Ariane DeVogue. So the Supreme Court's famous for its collegiality. What's going on here?
Right. Well, Justice Sonia Sotomayor suffers from diabetes, so she's in the high-risk category here. And from the start of the term, at every argument that I've attended, she has always been wearing a mask. The other justices haven't been wearing a mask. But then in January, when the infection rates really started to soar, the court released a statement saying that Justice Sonia Sotomayor would now be participating remotely. And the court spokesman made clear that she was not ill. Well, now sources tell us that Sonia Sotomayor feels uncomfortable sitting on the bench if her colleagues are unmasked. And they say that she made that concern clear to Chief Justice John Roberts, although we're not quite sure what John Roberts did with the information. So when that argument started, the first argument of the January term, all eight justices appeared in the courtroom wearing masks, except for Justice Neil Gorsuch. Now, during arguments, some of the justices took off their masks for a period of time, although the two liberals kept the masks and they keep the masks on at all times, even when they're asking questions. So we've asked the Supreme Court to give us some comment about Gorsuch, why he's choosing not to even bring a mask to oral arguments, and they haven't responded. It's worth noting that all of the justices are vaccinated, they've received their boosters, and they're also frequently tested.
I want to read something from Justice Gorsuch's book titled A Republic, If You Can Keep It. It reads, "To be worthy of our freedoms, we all have to adopt certain civic habits that enable others to enjoy them, too." He went on to talk about a civility crisis this country is facing, which, you know, is certainly accurate. It's just kind of interesting given this latest reporting. Can Chief Justice Roberts determine what people, whether people wear masks on the court or not?
Well, I think it's been proven in the last few weeks that Chief Justice John Roberts only has one vote on this court. And I think he doesn't see this as his responsibility to mandate masks. That said, I covered an event, a Zoom event, with Gorsuch and Sotomayor last year where they talked a lot about civility together and their own friendship. But she is being very cautious here because she is high risk. And I did have a source tell me that Sotomayor never directly asked Gorsuch to wear a mask. And one other important thing is the fact that just recently the court did block President Biden's vaccine mandate. They were on opposite sides. And during oral arguments, Sotomayor spent a lot of time talking about the impact of the pandemic on people with pre-existing conditions.
Hmm. Ariane DeVogue, appreciate the reporting. Thank you.
Thanks.
Up next, a look at President Biden's first year in office and the challenges he's faced both here and abroad. President Biden is set to hold a press conference tomorrow at 4 o'clock on the eve of his first anniversary in office. It's been a year afflicted with a global pandemic, opposition from both the former president and his supporters, the president's own strategic and policy blunders, and several global crises. CNN Chief National Affairs Correspondent Jeff Zeleny captures the year's ups and downs.
This is our historic moment of crisis and challenge, and unity is the path forward.
As President Biden enters his second year in office, that unity is elusive, with the very same crisis and challenge still burning red hot and complicating his path forward. The optimism from Biden's inaugural address,
bringing America together,
tempered by the bitter reality of a capital and a nation even more divided, and a president scrambling to find his footing. From an unrelenting pandemic, to stubborn inflation, to dangerous threats to democracy at home and across the globe, the White House is trying to reset and restore a floundering presidency. Tonight, election reform on the cusp of failing in the Senate, the latest example of the limits of presidential power in today's Washington, where Republicans are loath to cooperate, and Democrats with a razor-thin majority struggle to compromise.
There's been a lot of progress made. We need to build on that. The work is not done. The job is not done. And we are certainly not conveying it as.
Still, in March, Biden signed a $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan to ease the economic fallout from COVID-19. And months later, a $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure plan.
Bravo.
A landmark accomplishment that has eluded presidents of both parties.
Despite the cynics, Democrats and Republicans can come together and deliver results.
But that bipartisan bridge did not extend to the second part of his economic agenda, the Build Back Better plan, stalled in the Senate and facing an uphill road in this midterm election year. But above all, top White House officials concede the first year of the Biden presidency has been complicated and consumed by coronavirus. Remarkable gains were made on vaccines, but the president's summertime declaration of success proved utterly premature.
It no longer controls our lives. It no longer paralyzes our nation. And it's within our power to make sure it never does again.
A fall wave of the Delta variant, followed by a winter surge of Omicron, laid bare the failures in COVID testing and eroded confidence once again in the administration's grasp of the crisis.
It's clearly not enough. If we'd known, we would have gone harder, quicker if we could have.
On the world stage, Biden reassured allies after the whiplash of the Trump era.
America is back.
Yet the prospect of a new Cold War is now an urgent fear. That was not apparent during Biden's summit with Vladimir Putin in June, which focused on cyber attacks, a threat overshadowed by Russia's aggression toward Ukraine.
Look ahead in 3 to 6 months and say, did the things we agreed to sit down and try to work out, did it work?
Biden sought to reset the Russian relationship. Now Putin is testing Biden and Western allies. For all the challenges outside any president's control, one of the most devastating periods of Biden's first year was a decision that he made and stands behind.
I was not going to extend this forever war. And I was not extending a forever exit.
The swift fall of the Afghanistan government and the chaotic evacuation that followed, including 13 Americans killed in a suicide bombing, raised critical questions about competence that Biden and his team still struggle to shake 6 months later.
I take responsibility for the decision.
Yet taking responsibility marks a noted change between Biden and his predecessor, who looms even larger 1 year out of office. That point was clear on the anniversary of the Capitol attack.
He's not just a former president. He's a defeated former president.
And that, advisors say, is a glimpse into Biden's current mindset. He's no longer ignoring Trump and his assault on democracy. The outcome of his second year will help shape how Biden answers the biggest question of all, likely by this time next year. Will he run again?
Now, we are told the president spent the majority of his day preparing for that press conference, but Anderson, also we're told he's been reflecting on his first year in office. No one has ever come into the presidency with as much experience as President Biden. The question now is, how will he use that experience going forward in the second year? Will he be offering any big changes? The White House is not saying that directly. They say he will tout his progress tomorrow, as well as owning up to some shortcomings. But the key question, will there be any big changes going into year two? We may get a glimpse of that tomorrow, Anderson.
Jeff Zeleny, appreciate it. Again, the president's press conference is 4 p.m. Eastern tomorrow. Of course, CNN will have full coverage of it. Disgraced South Carolina attorney Alex Murdoch is facing nearly 50 criminal charges, and tonight, new details on how there could be even more. Next. There's new information about the legal troubles facing disgraced South Carolina attorney Alex Murdoch, who is accused of financial wrongdoing and coordinating a failed insurance fraud scheme that centered on his own faked suicide. Today, he lost his request to lower his bond, keeping it at $7 million. And on top of the 48 charges he's already facing, the state Supreme Court is now requesting records in additional cases that are related to him. 360's Randy Kay tonight gives us a look at one of those cases.
When 19-year-old Hakeem Pinckney was severely injured in a car accident, his family thought they'd found the perfect lawyer to handle the case. His name was Alex Murdoch. The same Alex Murdoch who years later would be facing dozens of charges for stealing millions of dollars from former clients and having to explain a botched fake suicide attempt.
He was a predator. Alex Murdoch was a predator who did not care about your life circumstances.
Justin Bamberg is the new lawyer representing Hakeem Pinckney's family. Bamberg, who is also a South Carolina state representative, says Alex Murdoch allegedly defrauded the Pinckney family out of as much as $1 million.
Almost $1 million is gone and unaccounted for, and no one knows where it's at.
The latest turn in the Murdoch saga dates back to August 2009, when a tire on the car Hakeem Pinckney was riding in came apart. The car rolled over in Hampton County, South Carolina, and Hakeem was left a quadriplegic, unable to move his arms or legs. Hakeem's mother, who was driving, also suffered grave injuries along with his sister and cousin. So Alex Murdoch sued the tire company on Hakeem's behalf. In the process, Bamberg says Murdoch arranged for this man, Russell Lafitte, to act as Hakeem's conservator or guardian. At the time, Lafitte was president of Palmetto State Bank, and this is where things get complicated.
What ends up happening at the end of the day is the trusting, injured, honest person who just believes their lawyer ends up getting duped.
The Pinckney case is one of the cases mentioned in the subpoena sent by the state Supreme Court Disciplinary Office to Hampton County, asking for records in cases involving Murdoch and Russell Lafitte. Court documents obtained by CNN show Murdoch settled with the tire company on behalf of Hakeem and his family. Trouble is, according to Bamberg, money that Murdoch should have sent to his clients, Hakeem's family, was instead sent to Palmetto State Bank and deposited into a bank account there.
And the money completely vanishes. Even today, we have no idea where that money went.
Hakeem passed away in 2011, 2 years after the accident. Bamberg says this check for more than $309,000 from December 2011 was drawn on the trust account reserved for clients' money from Murdoch's old law firm. The check is made out to Palmetto State Bank instead of Hakeem's family. According to Bamberg, the checks in question were first discovered by Murdoch's former law firm last fall, as they began to dig into more recent allegations against Murdoch. They also include this $60,000 check that was paid to Palmetto State Bank. The memo says it was for a conservator fee regarding Hakeem Pinckney. The conservator, according to court records, was Russell Lafitte.
And every penny of this money was intended for these people to be able to take care of themselves.
The president of Palmetto State Bank told us it permanently severed the employment of Russell Lafitte on January 7th. Legal counsel for the bank also said they are deeply concerned about the troubling allegations regarding Hakeem Pinckney's settlement funds and are looking into it. Lafitte has not been charged with a crime and has not responded to our request for comment. Murdoch's lawyer declined to comment.
It's the same exact pattern and scheme that we saw in the Satterfield case.
Gloria Satterfield was Alex Murdoch's housekeeper. And back in 2018, Murdoch schemed to defraud her family of millions of dollars. The housekeeper died after falling down the steps at Murdoch's home. It wasn't until December that Murdoch apologized to Satterfield's children and agreed to a $4.3 million judgment against him, money he'd kept for himself all these years. Randy Kaye, CNN, Palm Beach County, Florida.
And that saga continues. We'll be right back. A reminder, don't miss Full Circle, our digital news show that gives us a chance to dig into some important topics, have in-depth conversations. You can catch it streaming live at 6 p.m. Eastern at cnn.com/fullcircle or watch it there and on the CNN app at any time on demand. News continues here on CNN with Brianna Keeler and Democracy in Peril. Brianna?
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.